Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
Dealing with the Past, a Russian History. Gudrun Persson. According to the old anecdote, in the Soviet Union the future was simple and predictable. The problem was that the past kept changing. This anecdote raises questions about the constant features of Russian history and what drives change, reform and revolution, predictability and unpredictability. More specifically, it raises questions about the return of history in the late 1980s and how it is used today. The focus here is exclusively on the official use of history, not the valuable historic research that is being done in Russia today. Soviet official history could be said to be characterized by eradication and construction. The first famous textbook trying to control history was History of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, Bolsheviks, known as Short Course, published in Russian in 1938 and in English in 1939. It was written during the Great Terror, 1936 to 1938, when the old party elite and military elite were physically eradicated. The Short Course clearly shows that official Soviet history writing was a tool in the service of the propaganda, a decree about how history should be rather than how it was. In the introduction, it is said that the study of the history of the Communist Party helps us to master Bolshevism and sharpens our political vigilance. Blank spots were created not to be mentioned or researched at all. These include the First World War, the repression, the Gulag, the famine in the 1930s. People were literally eliminated from history and became non-persons. One example is when Security Chief Lavrenty Beria, 1899 to 1953, was ousted after Stalin's death in 1953. The editors of the Great Soviet Encyclopedia sent a new article and asked the subscribers to cut out the article on Beria and replace it with the new entry on Bering Strait. At the same time, hardly any country had so many official anniversaries to remember different historical events: the Battle of Borodino, the first man in space, the day of the Soviet air defense, etc. It was almost a reflection of an effort to beseech history, to try to control it so that nothing unwanted would turn up from the past. And initially, Mikhail Gorbachev was not enthusiastic about looking back. In June 1986, he noted, "If we start to dig in our past, we will lose all our energy. We must look ahead." Nevertheless, in the late 1980s, history returned and became an important agent for change and ultimately the dissolution of the Soviet Union. It is an irony, perhaps, that Boris Yeltsin, as party boss in Sverdlovsk, Yekaterinburg, in 1977, decided to demolish Ipatiev House, where the Tsar and his family were murdered. And in the 1990s, as president of Russia, he allowed the remains of the Romanovs to be buried. Now, a cathedral, Church on the Blood, stands on the demolished grounds of Ipatiev House in Yekaterinburg. The end of the 1980s was a time of curiosity and revelations. Many of the previously secret parts of history were rediscovered in books covering everything from the murder of the Tsar's family to the First World War and the Civil War, from the political repression to the Gulag system. Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago was published, Ossip Mandelstam's and Anna Akhmatova's previously unpublished poems came out, the early revolutionaries Lev Trotsky and Nikolai Bukharin rose from the grave of silence. The NGO memorial, dedicated to covering the political repression, was created with a mission to literally dig into the past. These are just a few examples. History had come back with a vengeance. It was an almost uncontrolled flood of discoveries. The current use of history in Russian policy includes the political leadership's search for a national identity under the name of patriotism. This is one of the classic questions throughout Russian history. Кто мы? Who are we? And one that President Vladimir Putin has labeled a Russian national sport. One reason for this might be that Russia, within 70 years, lost two empires, the Tsarist Empire in 1917 and the Soviet Empire in 1991. History tells us that losing an empire is never easy for any country. The policy of patriotism under Putin has developed slowly but steadily, with use of history a vital component. This is a policy with wide implications, since the use or abuse of history by the Russian leadership goes way beyond rhetoric. It is an integrated part of Russian policy that has a direct effect both on domestic politics and on Russia's neighbors. The military aspect is vital, though often ignored, where the Russian armed forces have a key role in implementing Russian policy by correcting historical injustices, as Putin has phrased it. To fight against the falsification of history is regarded as an important task for the armed forces. The military doctrine, a document where the main objectives for the Russian armed forces are described, also includes the task of defending Russia's history. It is a part of the wider battlefield in these times of so-called hybrid warfare. The current trends in Russian policymaking revolve around the dominant major schools of strategic thought in Russia. Simply put, one line emphasizes the imperial tradition, where territories are seen as an important instrument for great power Russia and serve as a buffer zone in order to secure Russia proper. This policy is associated with, for instance, Tsar Nicholas I, 1796 to 1855. The other school argues that to make Russia great, it should focus on the advance of its own resources, develop the economy, and devote resources to its own population, such as education, infrastructure, and healthcare. At the international level, Russia should show its strength at the negotiating table rather than on the battlefield. This school of thought is associated with Tsar Alexander II's foreign minister, Alexander Gurchakov, 1798 to 1883, who coined the famous phrase, "Russia is not sulking, she is composing herself." At the moment, Russia seems to be both sulking and composing herself. But these schools of thought often coexist and are not mutually exclusive. The result is a policy that oscillates between two poles. During the Soviet Union, major revisions of the official history were made several times. Today, many versions are still allowed, but the tendency to take control of the official history is very clear. To illustrate the importance the current political leadership attaches to the official writing of Russian history, I will give a few examples, evolving around three themes inspired by the book Post-Memory by the Russian poet and essayist Maria Stepanova: corpus, document, monument. Some of these efforts have their roots in the Soviet legacy, in trying to control history at a time when history was used as the propaganda tool of the Communist Party. Corpus. One of the distinct features of the period after Vladimir Putin first came to power was the reburials. Most well known is the last Tsar's family, shot in 1918, which was buried in St. Petersburg in 1998. Later, the widow of Alexander III, Maria Fyodorovna, 1847-1928, was reburied. She was Princess Dagmar of Denmark and mother of Nicholas II. She had come to Russia in 1866 to be married and left the country in 1919. She was reburied next to her husband in the Peter and Paul Cathedral, 87 years after she left the country. Another prominent reburial was that of General Nikolai Batyushin, 1874 to 1957. He had served as the head of the military intelligence in the army during the First World War. He fought on the white side during the Civil War, fled abroad, and eventually died in Belgium. In 2004, his remains were transferred to Moscow, where he was buried with military honours. In 2005, the remains of Anton Denikin, 1872 to 1947, were brought to the cemetery at Donskoy Monastery in Moscow. Denikin was Lieutenant General in the Imperial Army, and he had also fought on the white side. His grave is close to that of philosopher Ivan Ilyin, 1883 to 1954, who had been forced to leave Russia in 1922. His highly contradictory ideas and thoughts have gained some momentum in post-Soviet Russia, and Vladimir Putin quoted him in his annual address in 2005. At the same cemetery rests the author Ivan Shmelyov, 1873 to 1950, who died in Paris and was reburied in 2000. These different fates, two military officers, one philosopher and an author, have returned to a country that tries to be reunited with its history. At the same time, Lenin in the mausoleum on the Red Square in Moscow still awaits his funeral. Document. In February 2013, Putin ordered the Ministry of Education to create new history textbooks for schools that should contain a single interpretation of Russian history. He underlined that the new textbooks should not contain any contradictions or double interpretations. This proved easier said than done. A conceptual document was compiled, the so-called Historico-Kulturni Standard, Historic Cultural Standard. Its purpose is to be a basic document to be used in the rewriting of textbooks for schools. Incidentally, all this was preceded by the Presidential Commission on Fighting Falsification of the History Against the Interests of the Russian Federation, which was short-lived and existed only between 2009 and 2012 when it was dissolved, ironically the very same year that was the official Year of Russian History. In the guiding document, no unity could be reached on how Russia's and then the Soviet Union's expansion in Caucasus, Central Asia, and the Baltic states should be described. According to Alexander Chubarian, head of the Institute for General History at the Russian Academy of Sciences, who led the expert group, almost all former Soviet states, except Belarus, called the times under Russian-Soviet dominion colonialism. This cannot be accepted by Russia. Furthermore, the very existence of such a conceptual document has been questioned in Russia because it is a reminder of a totalitarian order dictating history from above. Phrases such as «kulturnaya revolyutsiya» are associated with the short course. The phrase «Stalin socialism» is still there, in spite of promises by Chubarian that he would not approve it. These phrases are strongly loaded and are associated with the Soviet propagandistic history. This illustrates the conflict between the political leadership's ambitions and the professional historian's approach. In addition, in 2016, the president put the Russian Federal Archives, Rosarchiv, under direct presidential control. The background was that the longtime head of the Federal Archives, Sergei Mironenko, had published a document that clearly indicated that one of the most revered stories of heroism during the Great Patriotic War, about Panfilov's 28 guardsmen, was in fact a deliberate falsification by Soviet officials. Mironenko resigned from his post. As a consequence, the Rosarchiv is now one of the so-called power ministries. There are a total of 13 federal ministries, services and agencies that are directly subordinated to the president, including the Foreign Ministry, Ministry of Defense, and the Interior Ministry. Certain subjects of research are becoming increasingly difficult to examine, such as the Red Army's violent actions in Germany at the end of the Second World War, and the partisan movements in Ukraine and in the Baltic states which fought against the Red Army. Monument. If the 1990s was the era of tearing down monuments, the 2010s is the era of erecting new ones. This echoes what the architectural historian Vladimir Paperny has called Kultura 2, Culture 2. He describes the early Soviet state's obsession with the destruction of the past to make a complete break with times past, and contrasts this with the development in the 1930s, when hierarchy, order, and vertical power all came back. The development, according to Paperny, is like a pendulum swinging from one side to the other. First, it should be said that Victory Day, the 9th of May, during the last 20 years has become a fundamental part of Russia's identity building, a monument in itself. The military parade has grown over the years, and since 2015, civilians are marching in the so-called Immortal Regiment. This practice of marching with portraits of family members who died in the Great Patriotic War, 1941 to 1945, began as a grassroots movement in the city of Tomsk in 2011, but has since largely been co-opted by the government. Equally important, however, are the other examples of newly erected monuments. On the 1st of August 2014, in Moscow, President Putin inaugurated the first official monument ever to the soldiers of the First World War. He said that Russia almost won the war, but the victory was betrayed. He stated, "Russia withstood the attack and was then able to launch an offensive. The Brusilov offensive became famous throughout the whole world. But this victory was stolen from our country. It was stolen by those who called for the defeat of their homeland and army, who sowed division inside Russia and sought only power for themselves, betraying the national interests." In the wake of the annexation of Crimea and the ongoing war in Donetsk and Luhansk, the underlying message was very clear. Those who are against us in Ukraine are to be seen as traitors. In his speech on the 18th of March 2014, when the Crimean Peninsula was formally included in the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin used words such as fifth column and national traitors to describe those who were not in favour of annexation. Another example is the monument to Prince Vladimir, erected on the 4th of November 2016, the Day of National Unity. Prince Vladimir Christianized Russia in 988, and a monument in his honor is now standing close to the Kremlin in Moscow, facing the Christ the Savior Cathedral. He was never in Moscow, but according to some sources, he was baptized in Crimea. Furthermore, it is noteworthy that during the centenary of the Great Russian Revolution, which is the official name for both the February and the October revolutions, no official commemorations involving the political leadership took place. However, President Putin inaugurated a monument to Tsar Alexander III with the quote attributed to the Tsar, "Russia has only two allies, its army and its navy." A second inauguration in 2017 involving the president was the cross to Grand Duke Sergei Alexandrovich, 1857 to 1905, within the territory of the Kremlin in Moscow. Sergei Alexandrovich was murdered in 1905 by a terrorist, and the memorial cross was erected 3 years later, only to be destroyed by the Bolsheviks in 1918. Putin said, "Russia's history is regaining its unity. We treasure each page in this history, no matter how difficult." In view of the fact that monuments to honour Ivan IV, the Terrible, and Stalin are being erected in today's Russia, it is evident that a blind eye is being turned to the darker side of Russian history. These two were rulers with several thousands and millions of lives on their conscience. Putin, in 2016, formulated his approach to Russia's past. "We need history's lessons primarily for reconciliation and for strengthening the social, political, and civil concord that we have managed to achieve. Let's remember that we are a single people, a united people, and we have only one Russia." To sum up, I do not think we necessarily learn anything from history, but it is clear that the current political leadership in Russia does, and in that sense, puts its future in the past. It is a policy that leads to tension, both at home and abroad. As William Faulkner wrote in Requiem for a Nun, the past is never dead. It's not even past.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.